Do you mind if I put this up here? Is that right? Excellent. In fact, I might even put it over here. Good morning. Thanks for passing those out, Vern. I appreciate that. There's too much there to cover today, but I was kind of just jealous to give you something to take home and study over the next few weeks. So don't be intimidated by what you see there, okay? If you record it, that'd be great. Okay, this morning, I want to continue working on the character of Jesus. And I was here in September, and I introduced the whole subject of John 14:9, that verse that says, if you've seen me, Jesus is speaking to his disciples, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And trying to figure out what that verse meant. And in September, I spent a little time trying to develop a character sketch of Jesus for you. And we covered a few topics. At one point, I looked at his tenderness with the children, Jesus' tenderness with the children. And then I looked at his heart going out to the widow of Nain, his compassion when she lost her only son. And then we talked about Jesus protecting the woman caught in adultery. I had never really thought about Jesus protecting people, but I could see it for the first time some years ago with him with the widow caught in adultery. And then I talked about his clean anger with the synagogue ruler when the synagogue ruler finds fault with him healing the woman that's bent over. And I tried to develop a character sketch from his tenderness all the way to his clean anger and some things in between, and just try to give you a sense for the texture of Jesus. I'm going to continue that today. And and go a little further with that. Again, don't be put off by the notes too much. There's more there than you can get to. One of the things I wanted to hit right at the beginning was just some aspects, and here's what I'm going to do today. I'm just going to look at some different emotions of Jesus real quickly. I'm going to contrast his strength and his meekness a little bit to give you the endpoints of his character, and then we're really going to hone in on how he relates to Peter, specifically with Peter's failures. And I want to do that as to show you how Jesus relates to people like us, people that follow him. Now, this is different than how Jesus relates to the Pharisees. If you have a yes in your spirit for Jesus, which is why we're here, then you're following him and you're a disciple, and we can get a context of how he relates to us, especially in our failures and in our sins when we look at Peter. But if there's people that have a no in their spirit for Jesus, like the Pharisees, they're not just immature and failing, they're in rebellion against God. There's a big difference between immaturity and rebellion against those that are trying to follow him and are failing in ways and sinning and succeeding in ways, versus others that they're not even trying to follow him. They're actually opposed to him. So when you read the Gospels, you need to straighten those two out because he responds in different ways. And then we're just going to, at the end, we're just going to do so what? So what does it matter? And I'm going to try to make a couple life application points. So that's what we're doing. Just quickly, here's just some interesting emotions. I don't know if you've considered this about Jesus. I was impacted when I read about the centurion and his faith, and I'm not going to go in a lot of depth on these, but you may remember them. Oh, thanks. That's the slide, and it's just kind of character elements of Jesus. And I've kind of got the left side, more tenderness, and the right side is more his intensity, his fierceness. And in the middle is all sorts of interesting things like his approachability, his protection, his patience. And the more you dig into the character of Jesus, John 14:9, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, the more you know the character of God. And that just enhances your ability to really trust him strongly and deeply. Well, I'm going to leave this slide up a bit so that you can think about his character. So anyway, at one point, I watched how Jesus interacted with the centurion's faith, and it says he was amazed when the centurion basically said, I believe that you can heal my servant. I thought that was amazing that Jesus could be amazed. I'm like, well, yeah, he's God, but he's a human. I thought it was interesting when he interacts with the woman at the well, he gets tired. That's why he sits down at the well. When the 72 disciples come back from their ministry trip, it says Jesus, in joy, he's filled with joy, and he praises the Father for revealing these things to little children. I was like, wow, Jesus, joy. Huh. I like that. At one point, the disciples, all the children are gathering to him. The children are coming to Jesus, and the disciples are trying to shoo him off. And it says he gets indignant with the disciples. At the very end of the Passover, at the very end of his life, he tells the disciples, before he's going to the cross, he goes, I have strongly desired to eat this Passover with you. And I was like, wow, Jesus has strong desires. He prophesies that one's going to betray him at that meal, meaning Judas. And it says, he's troubled. I thought, wow, Jesus could be troubled. The time when, right before he raises Lazarus from the dead, and Mary's talking to him, it says he's deeply moved in spirit. I thought, huh, that's interesting. Even in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he's praying before he is going to the cross, it says Jesus, an angel shows up to strengthen him, and he prays all the more intensely, and he's in agony as he's looking to the cross and looking as he's going to bear the wrath of God against sin for humans. It's interesting, at one time he heals a deaf and mute man, and he sighs before he heals him. And lastly, the Pharisees' hardness of heart distresses him. Now, the reason I throw those out to you is I want to build a texture into the character of Jesus for him, so that as you're praying to him, as you're talking to him, as you're trusting him for provision in this world, whether that's finances, relationships, health issues, whatever you are fighting the good fight of faith for, like Paul says, whatever you are reaching your hand out in faith, I want to paint a character sketch of Jesus that's got so much texture that you can see he's a real person that really existed, and somehow that's going to help you grab hold of the hem of his garment and say, Lord, I trust you for the help that my family needs. But you have to have granularity to who he is to be able to do that. So that's why I kind of lay these things out. I mean, he can be amazed, he can be tired, he can be filled with joy, he can be indignant, he has strong desires, he can be troubled. He can be in agony, he can sigh, he can be distressed at hardness of heart. There's a richness there to help you interact with him. I also like to contrast his meekness and humility with his strength and power. And there's a whole subject here, and I'm just going to touch on it real briefly, but it's fascinating. Jesus does certain things that are so interesting. At one point, you know, it's towards the end of his life. He's going towards Jerusalem for the triumphal entry and to go to the cross and the Last Supper and all of that. And they're passing through a Samaritan village on the way. And the Samaritans, they don't want to receive him. They're like, well, you're going on to Jerusalem. And, you know, the Jews and the Samaritans have an issue. And we don't want you to stay in our village. James and John, they get hacked off. They're like, Master, shall we call down fire on them and burn them up? I mean, they're thinking about Elijah, right, in the old days. You can read about this in Luke 9:51. And Jesus turns to them and says, you don't even know what spirit you're of. I didn't come to destroy people's lives, but to save them. He goes, you're very confused about how to respond to this situation. And Jesus does the most interesting thing. He leaves. In meekness, in humility, he just says, okay, you don't want me to stay. I'm okay with that. Now, he's probably tired because he's walked miles and miles, right? They're not driving cars back and forth between the cities and where he's preaching and whatnot. So he has to get back on the road and walk more. But in humility, he just says, okay. And I love that about him. He doesn't do the, Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator, I'll be back, right? That's not Jesus. But you got to know his character to know that. And you have to remember a second, just to contrast. Remember the power of Jesus. He's in the boat. There's an incredible storm happening. The disciples are so terrified, they wake him up out of sleep. And they say, Master, don't you even care? We're going to drown. And he looks up in a moment, assesses the situation out of a dead sleep, and says, silent, be calm. And the whole storm completely chills out. The sun comes back out. The clouds disperse. That is the raw power of Jesus. Right? I mean, it's amazing. Think about the strength of Jesus for a minute. He is whipped and abused and tortured, a scourging at that time before the Roman guards and Pilate and before the crucifixion, before he even gets crucified. That's whipped with a whip for at least 39 times, and that was the limit by the Jewish people. The Romans may have had no limit. And there's bones and bits of stuff in the whips. And Pilate presents Jesus before the people and says, behold the man. And Jesus stands. What does it take to endure that kind of torture and stand after that? And it's not just his physical strength that's talking about. It's talking about the strength of his will to make his body obey and stand. Think about the power of Jesus again. And I'm contrasting it to his meekness, right? Remember, he's just left this village. Says, okay. Think about when they come to arrest him in the Garden of Gethsemane and the whole entourage of guards and whatnot of the Pharisees approach, and he says, who are you looking for? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I am he. And power is released, and they actually fall to the ground. And it says that in John 18, 2 through 6. As soon as he said the word, they drew back, and they fell to the ground. So you have this stunning individual named Jesus who has power over nature, and he has power over people's bodies for healing. He has power and authority over the supernatural realm to deliver people of oppressive spirits. But he bumps it up a level. He has a power over nature with the calming of the storm. He has power over nature in the terms of power being released. They fall to the ground when they're trying to take him, the guards. And just the raw strength of Jesus to stand after being whipped 39 times, minimum, and beaten up, slapped in the face, hit in the face, mocked, hit with rods on his head with the crown of thorns there. And yet, when they say, we don't want you to stay in our village tonight because you're going on to Jerusalem. We don't like Jews. He says, okay, I'll go on. His disciples, they're hacked off. They're offended, but not Jesus. Isn't it interesting to see the contrast of the power of the Son of God with the humility and meekness of this man? And the tenderness by which he relates to the children. And there's something that happens inside me when I contrast his meekness and power. And I have to say, it all has to do with Vern's theme and your theme of the first commandment and worship. When I engage with his power and strength and his meekness on the other hand, all you can do is worship because I'm amazed and I'm in awe. And so I want to lay those out before you. And hopefully you can take this worksheet home and I have 35 copies in the back on a chair. If you like this subject and this material, grab one on your way out. Unfortunately, I didn't, and it's about 4 pages long, and it's just some helpful devotional stuff. If you want it, get it. I didn't have the right number to Xerox to give one to everybody. My apologies. it's interesting. I'll touch one more aspect on his humility before you dive into Peter. On another event in Mark 5, this is after he calms the storm, actually, he lands in the region of Gadara, or the region of the Gerasenes, however you want to say that. And there's this demon-possessed man, severely demon-possessed. And Jesus arrives and delivers him in an instant. And the people, they're used to this crazy man in the hills that you got to keep your children away from. They try to lock him up and you know, or tie him up or chains, and he'll break the ropes and chains, and he's just running wild in the hills day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out. And they've lived with this crazy person that's severely oppressed with demons. And Jesus shows up and delivers them in a moment. And the people come out from the region of the Gerasenes, and they see the man sitting in his right mind and clothed, right? He's got clothes on. He's got his sanity back. And they are terrified. You might ask, why are they terrified? They understand that a greater power has just arrived in this region of the Gerasenes and has completely delivered this man who was the wildest thing they could ever imagine. A greater power has not only dealt with him, but delivered him. And there's this sense of the presence of God, of the numinous of God, that, wow, what has happened here? And they come unglued, and they ask Jesus, please, can you just leave? They're terrified. They don't have the bandwidth. They don't have the understanding to process what's just happened. And so Jesus leaves. It's like, hold up, but you're the master. You have an agenda. You're leading. You have purposes in history and in eternity we can't even fathom. And you're just going to respond to these people and leave? And he does. It's fascinating, the humility and meekness of Jesus. And here's the thing. He doesn't leave with a bad attitude and say, well, you missed your chance. See ya. I'm never coming back here again. Like a human would do. The fascinating thing is he leaves in chapter 5. And if you read Mark carefully, in chapter 6 he comes back. So in Mark 5:14, you find this whole thing I've been describing. And in, look at that. In my notes, I've got Matthew 6:53, but that's Mark 6:53. A chapter later, they don't know it, he's going to come back. And he's going to say, I wasn't offended. And now I'm back. And he actually, the guy that got healed says, I want to follow you wherever you are. And he says, no, you can't go. Go tell everybody what I've done for you. He's the John the Baptist for the region. He goes and tells everybody, including the Decapolis, which is the 10 Gentile cities. So Jesus is already reaching Gentiles and not just Jewish people. But when he comes back to the region in Mark 6, they all have heard what Jesus did. They bring all their sick people, all their people that are being oppressed by spirits, anybody with an issue, massive revival, and Jesus heals them all. So not only does he leave, he actually comes back and says, I'm going to be back to help you when you're ready. Not only am I not offended, but I'm going to come back and help you. That's the kind of person he is. And when you know the kind of person Jesus is, and you read John 14:9, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I tell you, your faith is strengthened to hold on to God and say, Lord, I need physical healing. I need help with my finances. I need help with my relationships. Lord, I'm sinning. I'm sinning with repetitive sins. I've confessed to you time and time again. Help me. You can hold on to him because you have more texture about this incredible God-man that we are following. And we need that message actually strengthened and given to the unbelievers. There's nothing that warms an unbeliever's heart more than finding out about Jesus versus about doctrines or principles or their latest political Christian kind of confusion. It's like, now forget all that. I want to tell people about Jesus, but I've had to go on a 25-year hunt for his character. And I had to do that because my dad, God bless him, was just a really messed up man. My dad had a lot of issues. He's no longer alive. He died when I was about 23. I'm 46 right now, so it's been a long time. And he was manic depressive, and he had a lot of issues. I mean, it's like living with a drunk. They're up one day, they're down the next. They're ranting and raving one day, the next day they're trying to be your best friend. You just don't know which way they're coming or going. And I was so confused about the character of Jesus, the character of God. When I got saved, I'm like, who the heck am I relating to? So I had to go on a 25-year hunt through the Gospels to try to figure out, who am I trusting my soul to? And what I found out time and time again, he's so good, he's so good, he's so good. And on one end of the spectrum, you have his tenderness, his compassion, his humility, his longing for people, and his kindness. And that warms your heart. That's really often the best place to start, because that softens your heart. Then you start moving in the middle and discover his protection, how approachable he is, how patient he is. That's where we're going with Peter in just a minute. How faithful he is, and his self-control is phenomenal. And then I actually began to break into the really hard area, which was the right, you know, and this is just labels I'm making up, but the right area of his personality, his intensity, his fierceness, his clearing anger, it all scared me. Because I've been abused by power. I've been abused by angry people. My dad was a great example. We don't need to give up on anger. We need to understand healthy anger, right? So there is a table I handed out last time, and it's in those handouts back there as well, and it's on the website. There is this PDF of Jesus, and it's very similar to this one. And on the left side, you can have dysfunctional versions of compassion and tenderness, right? And a lot of a lot of people can get caught up in the left side. They only like the tender side. There's also a dysfunctional right version where some people, they're just all caught up in Jesus being angry and mean and whatnot. And like, hold it, you're not understanding him clearly. Let's understand healthy anger, clean intensity, clean fierceness that actually protects people. We don't want passivity. If nobody's angry about injustice, how are things going to get fixed? I mean, we don't want just passivity, but we have to understand what's healthy anger versus what's dysfunctional anger. And all I knew was the dysfunctional part. So studying Jesus actually healed my image of God that was so messed up from my own choices and my parents and the world. I mean, it's not fair to blame your parents for everything, because half the stuff was my fault, right? So, some of the cultural thing where, oh, it's always your parents' fault. Well, your parents aren't a scapegoat. We have to take responsibility for our own lives. And half that was my own choices. And the other half, we're up to 150% now. The other half, right, bad math, is just living in the world. We have a ton of examples about people that are angry that aren't healthy, don't have healthy anger. And so working on this right area and understanding Jesus' fierceness and intensity, clean anger, that really helped me heal and have a healthier view of God. And often Jesus' anger led to healing or protection for someone. So here's the meat of the message. When he relates to Peter, and Peter is great, because again, he's a follower like we are, not a Pharisee who's in rebellion to God. There's a big difference. Peter fails time and time and time again. Now, he also succeeds sometimes, right? It's just like us. We're failing sometimes, we're succeeding sometimes. We're a mixed bag. We're not all failure, we're not all success. Okay. Let me list some of Peter's failures for you. Jesus gives the parable of the four soils. And Peter comes up to him and says, "Now, what did you mean by that? I didn't really get that." And Jesus turns to Peter and says, "Are you still so dull?" I'm like, "Ooh, Lord, ouch." Because I relate to Peter. There's so much stuff Jesus said, and I've had 25 years to look at the book, and I still don't get it.
Right?
So Peter encourages me because he doesn't get it either. And in Matthew 16, you'll find this interesting thing. Jesus has fed the 5,000. He's fed the 4,000. Right, there's two different crowds that he's multiplied bread to. They get in a boat. They're going to go to the other side. And Jesus speaks to them. And he's always speaking figuratively, right? And there's a reason. He wants to develop ears that hear. He's always saying, you who have ears to hear. He's actually developing ears to hear in us as he speaks figuratively, and we have to listen and figure out what he's meaning. Well, he turns to the disciples, he's getting in the boat and says, hey, guys, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so they're in their little group back here, and they're like, the yeast of the Pharisees? Hey, Peter, do you know what he means? John, you got anything? James, hook me up. I don't know. I know what it is. We didn't bring bread. That's the problem. And Jesus comes over to him and says, why are you reasoning about not bringing bread? He goes, did I not just multiply food for the 5,000? How about for the 4,000? Indeed, I did. Do you think I could handle this little bread problem for 12? How is it you are unaware I was not talking about bread? I mean, they just don't get it a lot of times, and I don't either. But Jesus, in his patience, oh, I love the patience of God. Isn't it great? Because there's so much I don't get, and he is having patience on them, and he's having patience on us. That's who the master is. He is phenomenal. Well, that's one of his failings right there. And let me list a couple. So he fails to understand. One time, Jesus says, walk on water. Peter makes it halfway and fails in the middle and starts drowning. Jesus catches him. He fails to keep his eyes on Jesus. There's another time, there's three different times in scriptures, at least three that are recorded, that they're arguing about who's the greatest. I mean, it's sinful ambition. What if, I hate to take liberties with Vern and Al and somebody else, but what if Vern and Al and somebody else in the church were really arguing about, look, clearly, I'm the leader, I'm the greatest. No, you're not. Look, remember, I was with him on the Mount of Transfiguration? Yeah, that puts me first. No. I was with him when he raised Jairus' daughter. Yeah, well, I was there too, okay? Well, I walked on the water. Yeah, but you sank. Right? And it's cute, but it's very serious. This is called selfish ambition. I don't know really, I mean, I'm conjecture what they're really arguing about. They're arguing about who's the greatest. It's just sin. I'm gonna read this one for you. When he was in the house, in fact, let me read it right out of the text. This is Mark 9. When they came to Mark 9:33. When they came to Capernaum, they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet. Ha, that's so funny. They kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Right? Got done with the latest ministry trip. Hey, I prayed for this guy, saw him, got delivered. No, you ought to see what I did. But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 to him and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. And he took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, this little child, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. What's beautiful about this situation, they have sin in their lives, and Jesus does not reject them for it. He didn't say, oh my gosh, I've chosen the wrong guys. You guys, no, you're off the team. You're off the apostolic team. I'm getting some new people. You have too much sin in your life. You're not cut out for this. He does not reject them. He instructs them and is patient with them and continues to encourage and grow them, right? Now, in the one I mentioned just a moment ago, when Peter starts to sink in the water, this is Matthew 14. What does Jesus say? He's walking on the water. The disciples see him. When the disciples saw, and this is Matthew 14:26. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost. Well, not really. And they cried out in fear. I mean, they're going, ah! I mean, what if you saw a guy walking on the water in the middle of the night? It would be creepy. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. That's it. That's the right answer. Ding, 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 ding. It would be creepy. But Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Lord, now this, I love this one. Lord, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you walking on the water. I don't know if I'd say that. Why would you say, if it's you, tell me to come to you on, anyway, I love Peter. Come, he said. Wow, I bet he said, hey, I like that. Come on, get on the boat, cousin, let's go. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. When he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink, cried out, Lord, save me. Has the Lord ever called you in something in faith, and you've lost your faith in him on that project, on that calling, halfway through and felt like you started sinking? I have. To get depressed, lose my vision. And the Lord catches Peter, and he says, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Now, depending on your image of God, you may read that, oh, you have little faith. Why do you doubt? Accusation. Or, if you study Jesus long enough and you understand how he relates to his disciples, I doubt there was accusation. I see instruction in this. You have little faith. Why did you doubt? We don't have the volume, tone, color, anything. We've got the words from this time, and so you have to read into those and try to do it that in a healthy way. I think he's instructing him, saying, Peter, you can keep your eyes on me. Next time, whatever the issue is, remember to do that. Don't get your eyes on the winds and the wave. Fear is your enemy. I am your friend. I see instruction in that. Well, here's a big one. Matthew 16. Peter has this great thing go on where Jesus says, who am I, basically? And Peter, after a few other answers, he goes, you are the Son of God, the Messiah. He goes, well done, Peter. And then sometime later, Jesus discussing some other things. Matthew 16:21. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the elders and chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. Peter took him aside. Imagine him putting his arm around Jesus. Hey, Jesus, come here. Come over. Yo, you guys, stay over there. I'm going to have a little powwow with Jesus. Come here. Master, over here, please. He says he took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said, this will never happen to you. Now look at this. Jesus turned, and in one of the other Gospels, it says he looks at the other disciples. You got to read the parallel accounts. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan, for you are a stumbling block to me, and you do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. Then he says to his disciples, if you would come after me, you got to deny yourself and take up your cross. He's given Peter a severe rebuke, and it is discipline. It's correction. And it's instruction. But what it is not rejection. He didn't say, Peter, that's it. You've resisted the purpose I came to the earth. At least one of the top, you know, one of the top three, if not the top one. You're off the team. Jesus constantly instructs. He may discipline or correct, but there's no rejection in it. There's no rejection in it. Peter's still going to get to lead the church. And he's going to blow it bigger than this, right? Let's roll up to that. So Jesus has the last meal, the triumphal entry to Jerusalem. Everybody's waving palm branches. The Pharisees and the religious leadership, they've rejected him. They're not going to receive him as the king at that time, although they should have. He has the Last Supper. At the Last Supper, he talks to him and tells him all sorts of things. Then they go out to pray. And this is Jesus, probably his greatest trial in many ways. In Matthew 26, he's out in Gethsemane and he's praying as he's, I don't know all that he's doing, but he's pulling himself together to go through the cross. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And he took Peter and his two sons, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to him, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Isn't that interesting? Jesus wants mere humans. He wants us with him. And he knows what we are. He knows all of my struggles, my weakness, my sin. He also knows the positives in us where we want to do what's right. We want to reach out. We want to be like him. He doesn't just know the negative. He knows the positive. Right? Because we've all got both. Going a little further, he fell to his face and prayed to the ground. Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Again, I don't read accusation in that. That's Satan's voice, right? Satan condemns, God convicts. When you're convicted, you realize he's putting his finger on an area of sin because he wants to lift you. He wants you to realign with him. Realignment is called repentance. And he wants to encourage you. That's conviction. Condemnation is when Satan comes in and says, "Oh, I can't believe you did that. Oh, you're not worthy." Rejection, rejection. He's trying to break your spirit and get you to quit. You want to keep condemnation radically separate from God's conviction. They're both talking about your same, potentially your same sin or failure, but in two radically different ways. Well, I don't think he's accusing Peter right here. "Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? Watch and pray." I think he's instructing him, "Peter, pray. Potentially you're going to deny me in just a little bit. Pray." I think he's instructing him. Then, so Peter fails to stay awake with him and stay with the master. Well, we all know also that he denies Jesus. In Matthew 26:72, let me show you how bad it is. Just think of Peter's failure. 26:69 in Matthew. "Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came out to him. 'You also were with Jesus of Galilee,' he says, 'but he denied it.' Then he went into the gateway, and he saw another girl. 'This fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth.' And he denied it again with an oath." I don't know the man. An oath means you say, "May God do terrible things to me if I'm not telling you the truth. I don't know him." It's not just a denial, it's the denial with an oath. "After a while, those standing there went up to Peter and he said, 'Surely you're one of them, and your accent gives you away,'" because it was a Galilean accent. "Then he began to call down curses on himself and swore to them, 'I don't know the man.'" He didn't just deny him and say, "Oh, I don't know Jesus. See ya." He denied him with an oath and curses on himself. He failed to the limit that you can deny Jesus. And we all know the Lord restores Peter. Isn't that awesome? Yeah, it is just incredible. Look at a fascinating verse in Luke 22. As he's going through this denial, In Luke 22:60, it says, Peter replied, I don't know the man that you're talking about. And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. Then the Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Have you ever seen that verse? He's in the courtyard being interrogated by the guards or who knows what's going on with him. He looks through the rock blocking or the bars or whatever, and he looks at Peter. He makes eye contact with him in that moment. Depending on your image of God, you either see accusation on the face of Jesus, I told you so, Peter, or you see the truth, which is, Peter, I know you. I knew it would happen. Remember what I said. When you turn back, strengthen your brethren. I think there is instruction and support in his face rather than accusation. That's the one you're worshiping. That's the one you're giving your life to, right? So whatever you're doing, and here's one of the two words I got for this message today and for ministry time. Whatever your sphere of ministry in, is that you're a homemaker, male or female, raising your kids? Are you out working a job? Are you a student in college or high school, whatever? Are you in ministry, a leader or leading a home group or any element of ministry, pastor, whatever? If you fail or you feel like you fail, remember the one you worship, the one you serve. He is not accusing you, saying, you blew it too much, you're done. That's always Satan's voice. And you got to just say, whoop, change the channel. I was on the wrong channel on the TV, listening to the wrong stuff. Where's Jesus's voice? Oh, there you are, Lord. And he's saying, "If realign with me. Let me give you instruction. Let me strengthen you. And I want you to keep pressing forward in your sphere of ministry. Raising your kids, doing your studies, working a job, in ministry, whatever it is, or the combination of them. Stay steady. Remember who I am. Keep going. It's interesting. If you read the Old Testament, it's the whole same story of King David. I could line up King David's sins and failures for you. It's the same story as Peter. The Lord gives him mercy time and time again. Yes, there's consequences for some of our failures and sin. David had some consequences, but God forgave him and did not reject him. If you put up the second slide, that would be helpful. Thanks, Kurt. So why do I tell you all this? Well, it's a little hard to see. But in the circle is the beauty of God, which I call the character of Jesus. I think the character of God is his glory, by the way. And that drives all the different things we do. Worship, the first commandment, is straight up. Service to others is really the second commandment. And then all the other ones, real forgiveness, sharing about Jesus, prayer, devotion, work, repenting from sin, all of it is really driven by your knowledge of the goodness of God, of his image, of his character. But that's got to be clear. Now, I put in parentheses at the bottom, human will. Yes, he wants us to make choices to obey him, right? He wants us to commit ourselves. But the real power source is him. Okay. I want to comment on one last thing here. Matthew 25, you've all read the parable of the talents, the 5, 2, and 1 talent guys. The one talent guy's problem is his image of God is completely screwed up. He's filled with lies, and he's afraid of God. Let me show you why. In Matthew 25, he says, well done to the 5-talent guy. You risked with what I gave you. Well done. He gets the 2-talent guy, well done. You didn't have as much, but you know what? You used what you had. Excellent job. The 1-talent guy, he says, then the man who had received 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, Here's what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvested where I have not sown and gathered where I have not scattered seed? Well, then you should have deposited your money on deposit with the bankers. He goes, take the talent from him and give it to the one with 10 talents. The guy's got lies in his image of God. He thinks God's a hard man that doesn't give seed. Two lies, that God's hard and he gives no seed. That was my image of God. I heavily identified with the one talent man's lies. I saw God as hard and overbearing and demanding from things I couldn't give. So I was afraid of God because my father image, my choices I've made, interacting with the world. Look at that. God does not agree with the man's assessment. In the NIV, there's a question mark at verse 26. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gathered where I have not scattered seed? Question mark. God is not agreeing with his assessment. In fact, God's not a hard man. And he says, I haven't given any seed. What are the talents if they're not seed? Right? I gave you plenty. And he goes, here's the beautiful thing. At the top of this passage in Matthew 25, he says he gives each of the talents to everybody. And he says he gave each according to his abilities. And that's verse 15. To one he gave five, to another two, and to one one. Each according to his abilities. God doesn't give you too much or too little. And he didn't for this guy either. He goes, it was well within your ability to use your one talent. But you got to know who God's like. So, that's essentially the message. And Vern, if you want to help me with the next part, we can talk about ministry and whatnot. I thought God gave me a second word, which was, I was doing somebody's dishes last week, and the day after, I thought the Lord spoke to me and said, Chris, that's what I want to do on Sunday morning. I want to clean your dish. I want to clean their dish, their bowl. I'm like, what dish or bowl do they have, Lord? I don't get, you know, it's like, Peter, do you get what I'm talking about? I didn't. He goes, the bowl is what you drink the love of God from. All of us, he's feeding us on the love of God. Now, if you've got a dirty dish, you're trying to drink the love of God, and you've got some old food that's been left in that bowl for a couple days or maybe a week. Maybe you got some old vegetables stuck in there. Maybe you got a chicken bone in there, right? And you're trying to drink God's love, and that chicken bone goes down in my throat, and I'm like, and I'm coughing out all of God's love with the chicken bone, right? Today, he's healing and clarifying his image before you so that you can drink the raw love of God and not miss any of it. We're getting a lot of his love down, but we're losing some of it because we're not really clear about who he is and how he treats believers. We're not Pharisees. We're believers. Where you fail, he's going to instruct you. He may give you some corrections sometimes. He's not going to reject you.